Welcome to the Prophecy Club, and I've got my good friend Stan Deo on the phone with me today. Stan Deo has held, now get a load of this, an above top secret security clearance. He worked undercover for the FBI. He was part of an exclusive black project, which he's about to tell you about, headed up by Dr. Edward Teller, specializing in the development of flying saucer technology. That's right. He's not going to tell you what he thinks from watching some TV show or reading a book. He's going to tell you because he's been there and done that. He is an advanced propulsion engineer for marine, air, and spacecraft, author of two books on the subject. He's an amateur archaeologist in the Middle East, and he's explored some very interesting caves. And we'll have to make that the topic of one of our programs also. In the meantime, Stan Deo, welcome back to the Prophecy Club.
Thank you, Stan. Good to be here.
Stan, why don't we start with when you were just a normal person, a normal guy, and tell us briefly your story of how you wound up knee-deep into black projects.
I went to school there in Dallas. I was born down in Central Texas near Waco or Valley Mills. And I was a pretty good student in school and got appointment to the U.S. Air Force Academy and was there for about 20 months and had a big disagreement with them and left. And went back to Dallas and trained at IBM in systems analysis and programming with the big IBM computers. Had a job there with a rather large company. There were 100 companies in this conglomerate there. And at that company, I was in charge of systems and programming and a bunch of staff. So at that company, I had an executive coffee shop downstairs, and I went downstairs. And usually I went down when the rest of the people of the company didn't go down because I was an executive there. And one day I went down there, and this is a big cafeteria canteen type thing, and there was enough seating for about 1,200 people. There was only one other guy in there except me. He came in after I did, and he came and sat down across from me. And he's, you know, he was an accountant or actuary for one of the insurance companies this group owned. And he said to me, you know, hi, my name is, you know, Ted, and introduced himself, and we talked for a bit, and he wanted to know what I was doing, you know, for fun. I told him about at home on the blackboard in my office. I had stuff I was working on with a method of propelling flying saucers. You know, I think I could make one that would really, really fly rings around everything we had. And also, I told him I was working on a free energy device with an antenna and some things, and he just nodded and smoked his cigarette and went off. He told me there, he said, you ought to talk to a friend of mine named Maxwell. And I said, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll do that, fine, and forgot about it. He comes back a month later, catches me there, and sits down, goes through the whole thing again. He says, look, I've made an appointment for you to see this friend of mine, Dr. Maxwell, 3 o'clock this afternoon. Here's the address here in Dallas. Go see him. So I did go, and make a long story short, it turns out this Dr. Maxwell is the number two for Dr. Edward Teller project on developing anti-gravity and flying saucers and all kinds of other technology that people don't know about yet. And he recruited me there to go down to Australia to join the group down there.
Is that the one at Pine Gap?
Well, this was down in Melbourne where my control officer was Captain Sir John Williams. The Pine Gap facility had a number of other issues that they were doing, but they did have anti-gravity devices landing there in an airstrip that would, you landed, it looked like the desert floor there in the middle of Australia, but then it would just open up and sink down, and the aircraft would usually, like a 747, would come to a dead stop over that land on that piece of dirt, and then the dirt would just descend down into the base, and they'd roll it off, and then the dirt would come back up, and it still looked like desert. They had a base there, one up near Darwin, and anyway, the Pine Gap facility on its own was quite interesting. I mean, they had a 25,000-foot hole drilled underneath it to drop the antenna sink into so that they could do ELF broadcast to the submarines in addition to everything else they were doing, like a big Tesla coil. And if you look on Google Earth at images of Western Australia, up near the Learmouth Peninsula, which is, I guess, about half to three quarters of the way up on the left side, poking out into the ocean a bit, and you zoom down into it, you can see some of the antennae that even before Pine Gap they were using for this kind of transmission. And they were big Tesla coils. They're circular, and they look like spider webs. And some of them are like, you know, miles across. They're big. And there are things like this in California as well, as you can see on Google Earth. But anyway, that would be interesting. And now, back to, you know, why I went down there. The process I had developed, I was, you know, fairly quiet about, even though I talked to that guy in that coffee shop there in Dallas. I didn't give him all the details of how the craft would work or, you know, the power thing I was working on in any detail, because it was just an idle conversation with a guy I'd only met once before. However, when I went to that meeting that afternoon with that Dr. Maxfield, he seemed to know what I was doing. I mean, I remember sitting there in his office, and he would show me photos of him and tell her in a submarine going under the South Pole and stuff like that to a base, and telling me what they had done. And he said, now then, boy, he says, he had a big cigar, big tall guy, and he says, look, tell me what you've been doing there at home in your lab. And I said, you know, because by this time I was pretty much awed by dealing with a guy that was in radiation research and a mathematician supreme and working with Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, you know, and here I'm in his office and I didn't even have my degree, and I'm thinking, boy, how do you answer a question like that and not sound like an idiot? So I said to him, well, sir, I've been working on a theory about, you know, magnetism and electricity and gravity. He said, yeah, look, don't fence with me. He says, you're working on anti-gravity now. How far have you gotten? So, you know, my jaw hit the floor then, because anti-gravity is a pretty pedestrian word for these kind of guys. It's usually called electrogravitics. But so we talked, and he said, okay, well, we're going to send you down and make all the arrangements, and you'll be part of our team, and the Australian government will bring you to the country as an electrical engineer, and we will proceed from there. At that point, when I went down to Australia, my papers and stuff that I'd started to write on the plasma drives, which were a different kind of propulsion, but leading up to anti-gravity, they were immediately classified, and then, you know, my stuff was above top secret, and the normal people that review those things at what's called the Aeronautical Research Lab in Melbourne were prohibited from even opening up my file. And one of those guys, the reason I know is because he lived across the street from me, and he told me about it later. When I was in a meeting with the boss down there of the Aeronautical Research Labs, Tom Keeble was his name, I was with him and about three of his senior staff that had top secret or above clearance. And it was a small office. We were sitting in there, and they were sitting on one side of the office facing me, and Tom was at his desk, and we were talking. He wanted to know, had ASIO contacted me when I came into the country? And ASIO is the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, kind of like their FBI, I guess you would call it. And I said, no, they hadn't. And they kind of went, oh, that's good. And here I'm thinking, well, now, why is that good? If ASIO, you know, they're Australians, and if ASIO hadn't contacted me, that was good. And I'm thinking, you'd think it would be the other way around, that they ought to know I'm here and, you know, and cleared and everything. So I listened to them, and they talked about my propulsion system, and then they started talking about flying saucers and UFOs and film footage they had. And I said, you've got film footage of them flying? And they said, yes. I said, well, gosh, I'd like to see that. Yeah, because I knew they'd developed some different techniques to my own, but still, I wanted to see what they'd done. And as I said that, they were all sitting against the wall in front of me there, and there was a bookshelf up to the upper right of their right side. And they all said, oh, no, we couldn't do that. That's, you know, that's too classified. And shaking their, you know, heads, yes, but saying no and pointing up toward the bookshelf where the room was bugged by somebody. And that somebody apparently showed up just at the end of this meeting. I could see him out the window downstairs, you know, one of those stretch limousines. And Dr. Keeble got a call and said, something to him. He said, well, gentlemen, I got to go. It's time for my monthly wink-wink lunch with the guys. And I think that was probably Captain Sir John Williams, who was my control agent, and them. But the penny started to drop right that day that whoever I was working with was above Australian security and their own kind of laws and rules. And they worked underneath or hidden from the Australian security, which starts to make alarm bells go off. But it took me a year and a half or so to figure it out that these guys were the Illuminati that I was working for, that they were international scientists, financiers, knights, you know, Sir Johns and that kind of stuff, Sir Henrys. I was rubbing shoulders with people that told prime ministers what to do. In fact, I had to ring one of the deputy prime ministers and get him out of the shower one night to tell him to come to a meeting with Dutch Shell Oil. That was my instructions from the higher-ups. So I even got to talk and tell those guys what to do whenever I made a call like that. Of course, it was yes, sir, no, sir, how I, and, you know, they didn't argue. They just followed instructions. And these were the guys running the country. I'm sure it was that way, and possibly still is that way here in this country. Oh, by the way, in Russia, I found out that the equivalent rank to Edward Teller here, the head of our project, a special project, was Andrei Sakharov, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics and was detained permanently, under house arrest by the Russians. They didn't want him to leave the country. I guess it was something to do with the fact that he was the head of the undercover anti-gravity flying saucer-type project that was worldwide. There were tests done initially of these flying saucers using the electric propulsion on railway lines that were underneath ground in East and West Germany after the Nazis were defeated. These things were taken over by the Allies, particularly on the U.S. side. And they were short rail tracks, you know, less than half a mile, but they were in tunnels underground. They would put a flying saucer-type shape sideways on it, or, you know, tipped up on its edge, so that the center of the saucer was pointing down the track. And they would fire up the tests on these things with electricity. And one of the guards that was on duty there said to me, I could turn my head and look at it to the left down the track, from the middle of the track, you know, the midpoint, and they would pull the switch, and before I could turn my head all the way to the right to see it impact, it was already past me and gone and hit the end of the rail cushions where it was, you know, stopped. It was mighty. Now, these were being done, as I say, in underground facilities left by the Germans. I did part ways with these guys because when I started asking questions about why we were holding back the technology that should be given to some of the third world countries to save them, you know, even water like in Africa and food from the water, you know, teach a man how to fish and he'll survive. That was my concept. And they said, boy, you just don't understand. And it wasn't until sometime later when I was able to have a conversation in a private home with a CIA agent who was a friend of a British playwright that was a friend of mine, and he stopped over there in Perth because I'd already moved to there by that time. And he stopped over there and he had a satchel handcuffed to his left hand. And in the satchel, of course, was classified something or others. Turns out that he was very upset because he worked for the Illuminist in the Asia region there in a Asian Institute for Advanced Studies. And he had a piece of paper and he was having to take back a report to Langley to tell them that the way to cause a population attrition of 100 million people in Asia would be to strategically withhold grain loans at the right time, and that would cause 100 million people to die of starvation, which wouldn't be their fault, but it would reduce the population and give them such problems in those countries that they wouldn't be a problem to the rest of the developed world. Now, he wasn't happy about this. He started to drink a lot of alcohol because the guy seemed to want it, and he apparently passed out on the table with the thing still handcuffed to his wrist, but he had opened it to read us the report, and the report was just stuck there, and he never shut the briefcase and supposedly passed out.
We'll be right back after this message. Lindsey Williams has just released his new 3-DVD set. He says you must know the tactics of the elite in order to survive the new world order. Hear a Wall Street insider for the first time tell his story, along with four prominent professionals revealing insider trading violations, destructive derivatives, what congressmen, judges, and some lawyers know that you are never told. Learn what the younger elite are taught. Topics are secrets I've never told before, how the elite make and preserve millions of dollars, how derivatives make super wealth, insider trading that changes wealth to super wealth, Americans financially betrayed by Congress, how the elite use gold and silver to profit, the paper currency con job. Call 785-266-1112, not available on the internet. 3 hours, Tactics of the Elite. 785-266-1112, order Tactics of the Elite. Is it possible that an ancient harbinger holds the secret of America's future? That this mystery lies behind everything from 9/11 to the collapse of the global economy? Are the ancient harbingers of judgment now manifesting in America? Is God sending America a prophetic warning of what is to come? Before its destruction as a nation, ancient Israel received 9 harbingers, prophetic omens of warning. The same 9 harbingers now appear to be manifesting in America with immediate ramifications for end-time Bible prophecy. Hidden in an ancient biblical prophecy from Isaiah, the mysteries revealed in the harbinger are so precise that they foretold recent American events down to the exact day. The revelations are so specific that even the most hardened skeptics find it hard to dismiss. It sounds like a plot out of a Hollywood thriller, but it's real. Topics are, what is a harbinger? What are the 9 harbingers? What did the harbingers bring to Israel? Have nine harbingers hit America now? Was 9/11 America's first harbinger? Does Isaiah 9:10 prophesy the fall of America? Does the harbinger involve some of America's highest leaders? Does the Shemitah have a prophecy for America? Is there a harbinger, a prophetic warning hidden in America's consecration ground? How the harbinger fits into end-time Bible prophecy? Call the Prophecy Club. Ask for the Harbinger, 785-266-1112. The Harbinger, 785-266-1112. Call now. And now, back to the program.
And the reporter was just stuck there, and he never shut the briefcase and supposedly passed out. So I pulled it out and I looked at it, and Vince and I both knew the value of it. So we were in his home near the university, so he said, "Look, I'm going to run over and photocopy this, keep him company if he wakes up." So he ran over, photocopied it, we put it back in, and a little while later the guy woke up and, you know, said, "Look, got to go now. I've got a plane to catch here in the morning," and locked up his briefcase and left. Well, I think he purposely got drunk and left that there for us just to show that. But it was just part of a number of things that led me to believe that the objectives of the Illuminati weren't exactly friendly to a lot of the people of the earth. It was for a very select group of people in the Western world, and not even, you know, like China or the Arab nations, and in particular Israel. That really hacked me off when I found out that these guys that I was working for didn't like Jews. We did part ways, and they threatened to put me at the bottom of a deep mine shaft permanently, and I ran and used an assumed name and traveled thousands of miles and a few weeks to hide from them until I could get to safety in Perth. An agent did catch me in the desert, the Nullarbor Desert, just before I got to Western Australia, over a campfire with some people I'd hooked up with there, some hippies, and he knew who I was, and it was one of several people that had been sent to get me, and I guess to terminate me. But we talked for a while, and he said, "I'm going to let you go. I didn't see you. I'm going to go on to Perth, and, you know, good luck." He said, "You'll be okay in West Australia." So I was contacted by a member of ASIO and the West Australian police. The guy they sent over to get me was former bodyguard to the Prime Minister of Japan. He's one of these odd-job type guys that was really proficient with killing you with his hands and stuff. And they told me that, "Look, you're protected as long as you stay here in West Australia. The other states don't have the same attitude we do toward the Illuminati. Make this your home," which I did. And I lived there for quite a few years, about 30 years all told in Australia. They did take away the Illuminists. They did take away my passport. And they took away my U.S. citizenship. I still have the letter where they said they have done that. And I was not able to come back into the states except on transit visas in and out of the country all that time. When I did decide to come back to the States because of a dream vision I got, I couldn't get the State Department here to let me back in. They couldn't find my file. And they had an Australian working on the Australian desk, they call it, to process green card applications. So I applied. I was going to be getting a green card to come back home since I wasn't any longer a citizen. I waited a month, called back, and the guy on the Australian desk had gone on holidays. So I waited another month, and I called back to the State Department. "Oh, I'm sorry, he doesn't work here anymore. There's no one attending his desk." And I said, "Right, well, look, get my file." I gave him all the details, and he said, "Oh, your file's not on the computer. It's stored in a hard copy library somewhere. We'll have to look it up." You know, another month or two passed, nothing. So I had been contacted by a particular member of President Clinton's cabinet, a very highly placed member who had read my book, and he made it known that what I put in the Cosmic Conspiracy was the game plan. And that doing it the way I did was, you know, okay with him. Now, I called this guy's office, and he wasn't in. I said, "Well, look, just leave him a message and tell him that I need a favor." A week later, down in Australia, American consulate in Melbourne rang me and said, "Oh, Mr. Dale, you have good news. You know, they've found your file. It was a mistake. You never lost your citizenship. We're going to give passports and citizenship to all your children who were born down here, and, you know, welcome back." So it's who you know. I suspect they probably want to keep their enemies closer. And that's why they brought me back. But
okay, now, whereabouts did it come into play when they were doing some kind of an electronic download into your brain? I seem to remember that story.
That was at the academy when they were teaching us how to read books, you know, several hundred pages in a second. And there, the flash queuing. Our tests were after lunch when you're tired. And you sit into a darkened theater. and they have a machine that all you hear is a whirring sound when it fires onto the screen in front of your eyes, and you can't see any pictures or anything. All you see is like subtle clouds of black and white or something, you know, just no images, just going so fast, it was just a blur. I remember one afternoon we were there early in the piece, the first day I think it was, and they did that and told us we just read a 200-page book that was implanted into our subconscious mind, you know, along with whatever else I don't know. But we all kind of laughed, you know, and said, "Oh, right." And he said, "I'll prove it to you." And he started saying words like, you know, red and scarf and girl. And one old guy back up behind us, tall, thin fellow, we call him Stretch, and he jumps up and he says, "Oh, sir, sir, I see it." And we all turned around and thinking, what is he seeing? And he's looking in the air in front, there's nothing there. And he says, "I see it. I see a page from that book. And there's a girl standing under a street lamp on a corner, and she's got a red scarf on." And he started to repeat word for word what was on that page. And then the instructor said, "All right, put that page up on the screen." And he was right. He had it embedded in his mind. Of course, he responded quicker than the rest of us to the programming like that. But they would hit us with that kind of stuff. And then that night, you'd be very tired when you went to bed and just collapse and sleep a real deep sleep. It was different than normal times. And that would go on for several days while your brain was, I guess, cataloging and filing whatever they put into it. But
so tell us again then, from there, how did you get into the Black Projects and to learn some of their secrets, and what are some of those secrets?
As I said, I was recruited by Dr. Maxwell for Teller's Project and then sent down to Australia. Some of the secrets that they have are, you know, technological secrets, but the thing I think is most important is why they were holding this technology back from the world.
Okay, before you get into that, that sounds like a long topic. Let's get you to tell them about your book, The Cosmic Conspiracy. And folks, if you'd like to have it, you can call the Prophecy Club, 785-266-1112, and we can help you get it. Tell us about it.
Well, The Cosmic Conspiracy was a book that I wrote while I was down there in isolation in Perth, and it only occurred because I'd been overheard talking about my work at a private residence where I didn't know everybody there. One of them turned out to be a TV producer for a show they were making at Channel 9 there on flying saucers, UFOs, and that kind of stuff. And when they heard my story, they wanted to put it on TV. So I gave them about 20, 25-minute interview, and it became the top rating show they'd had for the station in the history of the company. A publishing company said, "Over Melbourne, let's write a book," and it started there. And basically, I wrote the book telling what had happened, about you know, how I was recruited, and then about certain technologies that had been developed that weren't being released for, you know, some reason. And then in the middle of the book, I explain why with the Illuminati. And the third main section of it is on the need for people to become believers in Yeshua or Jesus, and how to be saved out of what's coming, you know, to have eternal life. And it was basically my walk from being, you know, recruited as a technological developer to discovering the Illuminati's details, names and places and things, and then down to the need for being saved. And by the way, I, you know, although I was saved as a young person, you know, going to church with mom and dad and everything, I did not really, as a young man, want to go to church or do that kind of stuff, and I was a bit, you know, wayward. It was not until I was going to die out in the middle of the Nullarbor Desert, and I was running for my life, that I sat down one night reading a Bible that had been shoved in my hand as I was leaving a meeting over in Adelaide a couple nights before that. The little white-haired lady gave it to me, and she said, "Read this chapter here in the book of the Revelation." And so sitting down there in my car headlights with the engine running out in the desert, I was reading this Bible in the book of Revelation, chapter 13. And I said to the Lord, "Well, look, I don't know if you're there, but if you are, I expect we're going to be meeting each other pretty soon. And I'd like to be on good terms." And so, you know, I repent. And I said a few things, you know, that you would normally say and repent of. And I said, "I need your help. So thank you very much." And that was it. And I went to bed. Well, miracle after miracle started happening within days. When we left the desert, the people I was traveling went to the first little town there. And we had about, I don't know, 75 cents or so to buy food for the three of us. I went into like a mom-and-pop 7-Eleven, and I saw there was no one inside the shop, but it was open, and on the counter next to the cash register was this fresh loaf of bread and a nice big hunk of cheese. And I was thinking, boy, that'd be nice. It just smells great. And I'm waiting. I call out. No one comes. I'm thinking, I wonder if I should just grab that and run. So I didn't. And this lady came out in a few minutes, and she said, "Oh, can I help you?" And I said, "Oh, yes, ma'am." I said, "This really smells good here." I said, "Look, I've got 75 cents. How much of that bread and cheese can we buy for that?" And, well, she said, "Oh, no, that's yours for free." And I said, "What?" She said, no, don't pay for it. Take the bread, the whole loaf, and take the cheese." I said, "Well, why are you doing that? You don't know me." And she said, "Oh, the Lord told me to do that." I said, "The Lord did?" She said, "Yes." And she was a Christian. At that point, kind of the hair on the back of my neck was just straight out. And I thought, gee, it was only just a couple of days ago. Well, I'm having a chat with a man, you know. Okay. And thanked her very much.
Folks, you've been listening to Stan Dale, and I hate to have to cut it off too, but time has run out. Let me encourage you to call and get that book, Cosmic Conspiracy. Call 785-266-1112. That's 785-266-1112. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your prayers and your gifts of support. Now, from the Prophecy Club, some exciting opportunities for you. Is it possible that an ancient harbinger holds the secret of America's future? That this mystery lies behind everything from 9/11 to the collapse of the global economy? Are the ancient harbingers of judgment now manifesting in America? Is God sending America a prophetic warning of what is to come? Before its destruction as a nation, ancient Israel received 9 harbingers, prophetic omens of warning. The same 9 harbingers now appear to be manifesting in America with immediate ramifications for end-time Bible prophecy. Hidden in an ancient biblical prophecy from Isaiah, the mysteries revealed in the harbinger are so precise that they foretold recent American events down to the exact day. The revelations are so specific that even the most hardened skeptics find it hard to dismiss. It sounds like a plot out of a Hollywood thriller, but it's real. Topics are, what is a harbinger? What are the 9 harbingers? What did the harbingers bring to Israel? Have 9 harbingers hit America now? Was 9/11 America's first harbinger? Does Isaiah 9:10 prophesy the fall of America? Does the harbinger involve some of America's highest leaders? Does the Shemitah have a prophecy for America? Is there a harbinger, a prophetic warning hidden in America's consecration ground? How the harbinger fits into end-time Bible prophecy? Call the Prophecy Club. Ask for The Harbinger, 785-266-1112. The Harbinger, 785-266-1112. Call now. The Prophecy Club is sponsoring a Fullness of Time Prophecy Cruise. It's the biggest ship for 1 week with 4 awesome speakers on the largest cruise ship in the world, the Oasis of the Seas by Royal Caribbean. This prophecy cruise will be a revelatory time of preparation. You will enjoy prophetic worship, ministry, and Bible prophecy in 9 two-hour meetings on the cruise with me and 3 prophets, Leslie Johnson, Rick Madison, and Bree Keaton. Leslie has given over 5,000 prophecies. Jesus spoke to Rick while he was in a brain-dead coma for 27 days and said, "Go, tell everyone I am real, I still perform miracles, and I am coming in this generation." Rick's healing ministry has seen thousands saved, healed, and 20 people awakened from comas. A cloud of glory follows Bree Keaton everywhere she goes. So come, for 1 week, you will be bathed in worship, Holy Ghost meetings, prophetic ministry, and Bible prophecy, preparing you for the end times. Our Valentine cruise departs Fort Lauderdale February 9 through 16 of 2013. The ports of call are Nassau, Bahamas, St. Thomas, and St. Martin. Cabin prices start at $750 and go up. For information, call Pastor Sharon at 209-588-9565 or email heavenlycruises@gmail.com. You must book early to get your best cabin location, lowest prices, and to enjoy the payment plan. That's Pastor Sharon, 209-588-9565 or email heavenlycruises@gmail.com. Pastor Sharon, 209-588-9565 or email heavenlycruises@gmail.com.